But God the word temperance, that's an old word. How often do you hear that today? Little Jimmy comes home from school and, "Mom, the guys are bullying me there. They're picking on me." "Now, honey, I want you to show temperance when you go back to school tomorrow." "No. I want to hit them." "I want you to show temperance." "No. Show self-restraint. So show self-control." Those are the words we would use today. But that word temperance actually really came into common usage back before I was born with Prohibition. Prohibition in the United States was a national ban on the sale, production, and transportation of alcohol put in place from 1919 to 1933. The Dry Movement, I like some of the names they had back then. The Dry Movement was led by rural Protestants in both political parties, Democrats and Republicans. They actually agreed on something. Was coordinated by the Anti-Saloon League. The ban was mandated by the 18th Amendment to the Constitution and ended with the ratification of the 21st Amendment in 1933. Now, temperance. While we tend to think of temperance primarily with the use of alcohol, once again, Webster's Dictionary, as with many of the virtues, has given us a basic definition, and the use of alcohol is just one of those down the list. And Webster's defined it self-restraint in conduct, expression, indulgence of the appetites, etc. Well, this morning I want to handle this virtue from Webster's first definition, self-restraint in conduct, or self-restraint when everything goes wrong. Have you ever had one of those days when everything goes wrong? Talking to one of our people this morning. "How's it going?" "Not so good." Problems on Friday and yesterday, and those things come. Those things come. I enjoyed Josh's message a couple weeks ago when Manny was here and shared about his dad. I think, if I have it right, his green card had gone past his date. He ended up in jail. And if I remember right, his dad started a Bible study in jail, led some of the guys to the Lord. That's cool. Made me think a lot of Paul. How much time Paul spent in jail. What's our attitude when those things happen? "Oh, for crying out loud, why me, God?" We can have two responses. It's our choice. We can either just give it up and just turn our back on the Lord, or we can exercise self-restraint. It's all right to question God. "God, why? God, but God, I wasn't really doing anything that wrong. All Paul was doing was preaching about Christ. He didn't kill anyone after he was a Christian. He wasn't robbing anyone. He was living for the Lord, and he ended up in jail for it." And while we tend to think that jail time is a pretty hard, nasty time, Paul, in his ministry, was reaching Gentiles and Jews, what we would call the common person of the street, like most of us, you know, just we're not in high places in government or anything like that. But because of Paul's jail time, he ended up being able to speak to the emperor of Rome because of self-restraint. When thrown into jail, he said, "Okay, I'm going to live for the Lord wherever I happen to be." Those of you, I remember this well. Many of you probably don't. But as we slip back into the 1970s with the Watergate scandal, Chuck Colson, his part in the Watergate scandal, ended up serving time in federal prison. In reading one of his books, he indicated that I'm not sure if he'd come to the Lord much earlier on, or that right before he ended up doing jail time that he got turned around for the Lord. But as he goes into federal prison, because of what happened in the Watergate scandal, he turned back to the Lord. He ends up having to go into federal prison. What is he going to do there? But God, many said back then, what Nixon and the whole bunch had done was pretty much what all the presidents had done in one degree or another. So why did Nixon get the axe and all that? Well, politics. We'll never get all those answers. While incarcerated, Colson started prison fellowship ministry that's going strong today. And his focus on Christian worldview teaching and training, which led to his founding of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. While still alive, he died about a year and a half ago. I think he was 81. While still alive, he also had his daily radio commentary, Breakpoint, heard on more than 1,400 stations across the U.S. He received 15 honorary doctorates. And in 1993, was awarded the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, the world's largest annual award in the field of religion, given to a person who has made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension. While implicated in the Watergate scandal and everything started going terribly wrong, God got Colson's attention and turned him around for the Lord, which was the best thing that could ever happen to him. Jail time. Best thing that could ever happen to him. Colson, happened to Colson, considering what he made of his life after that. Took God all those years to get ready to get Chuck Colson ready for the ministry he had for him. Question is, how do we handle those times that hit? We feel like the bottom has fallen out of our world. I know a lot of people who've turned their back on the Lord and walked away. A lot of times it's because of tragedy. A wife in her late 20s, early 30s, dying in childbirth, and the husband with a brand new little baby. How do you cope? And I've heard testimony from people that they've just gotten mad at God and turned their back on him and walked away. And we can understand that. We can understand that. Is that right? No. How do we handle those really hard times? Now, we can just give up and throw it all away, or we can turn to the Lord, exercise self-restraint, and say, God, I don't know why. I don't understand this. But I know you do, and I'm going to walk with you through it. Now, Colson, he had gotten involved in some very illegal activities. Paul, in the eyes of Rome, had. Manny's dad, letting his green card expire. But a lot of times we face a lot of heartache and grief, and every now and then you hear on the local news that someone, after 18 years, because of DNA, they found out the person was innocent and they had not committed that crime. 18 years of lost life, or 18 years that they gave to the Lord while in jail. That's what Paul did. Well, this morning, I want to take a look at the life of Joseph. Now, last week, if you're with us, we saw that it took God 80 years. You know, I'm a little slow. But it took God 80 years to get Moses ready for his ministry, which lasted 40 years. And this week, we see a turnaround. It takes God 30 years to get Joseph ready for his 80-year ministry. Genesis tells us that Joseph was 30 years old when he became number two in all of Egypt. Last chapter of Genesis tells us he lived to be the age of 110. I thought it was interesting. It took 80 years to get Moses ready for 40 years to deal with a hard, stiff-necked generation of continual complaining. And it took him 30 years to get Joseph ready for 80 years, and we're not told that there was any of that problems that Moses had faced. Each one of us face a different kind of ministry. The point here is that whether 80 years or 30 years or however many years it's taking God to get you ready for what he has in store for you. You know, guys, people, are we paying attention to the Lord? He's getting us ready continually. And even though we're doing it, he's continually making us more ready. But are we paying attention to the Lord? Or are we just going about life doing our own thing? Gets harder and harder the more we ignore the Lord. God is patient. He's never in a hurry. He will not give up. He will get our attention. He got Chuck Colson's attention, and Colson ended up in federal prison for, I think, 7 months. What does God have to do to get our attention? You know, are we going to be smart and listen up, or are we going to be bullheaded like so many? And God is patient and is never in a hurry, and we can save ourselves a lot of grief if we show self-restraint when everything's going wrong. My theme this morning, be patient. God's way is always, and I don't know if Paula could have put a double line under always. Be patient. God's way is always the best way. We suffer from a self-centered complex. I'm right. It must be the will of the Lord because it seems so right to me. And after all, in all my brilliance, wrong. Wrong. God's way is always right. Now, I've not preached this message per se, but I preached on Joseph at our previous churches, and I did preach on our first year here, but I'm hitting it from a whole different tack, so this isn't my message from 2006. But I've upset people in a number of our churches when I start this message, because many tend to look at Joseph as a very godly man. And so he was after the Lord got a hold of him and turned him around, turned him into step with him. I think that Joseph in his teen years was an arrogant, spoiled brat. That's what's really upset some people, because they just see Moses in his adult years. I think he was an arrogant, spoiled brat. He was daddy's favorite, had a real problem with pride. So let's take a look at him. Open with me in Genesis 37. Last week, I preached through the whole book of Exodus, 40 chapters. Well, this week, we're going to look at the last 14 chapters of Genesis. First of all, we see Joseph's years of preparation. And Genesis chapter 37, verse 1, now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Now, in Genesis here, Jacob is renamed as Joseph, or as Isaac, as Israel. Sorry about that. And so sometimes it'll be saying Israel, sometimes Jacob. Well, they're talking about the one person. The nation of Israel was just in the birth process and had not become a nation yet. And so Jacob and Israel are one and the same people. Now notice in verse 2, these are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers, 10 brothers. He was the 11th, Benjamin was the 12th child. Pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Kid was a tattletale. Any of you young people here have problems with your siblings? Mom, do you know what? How many of you like to be tattled on? I see some funny looking grins out there. I think people know exactly where I'm at. If that tattletale gets us into real trouble, there can be revenge in our eyes. I'll get you for that. I see two brothers sitting back here. You know, I just kind of wonder what's... Judy, what can we find? No, let's move on here. he was a tattletale. And Joseph brought back a bad report to them, to his father. Well, now maybe he was just mentioning it, but notice how the brothers reacted. We take a look at verses 3 and 4. He was daddy's favorite. That adds to it. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was a son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And each translation renders this a little different. Many think it was a many skin tunic, kind of like a mink coat, which back in my day, that was quite a thing for a woman to have, was a mink coat. A mink is just yay long. They skin it, and they take the skins and tie them together and make a beautiful coat out. Mink is phenomenally soft fur. And it was quite the status symbol for the wealthy, for the woman to wear a mink shawl or a mink coat. A many-skinned coat. And so the translation in the Hebrew is not really clear whether it was a brightly colored coat. I've seen some movies on Joseph, and the thing is really a wildly colored coat, and others might just be. Anyway, it was obviously showing that he was very much loved by his fathers. Verse 4, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak on friendly terms. Notice how many times it's repeated. Look at the next verse, the last part. They hated him even more. Verse 8. So they hated him even more. Verse 11. His brothers were jealous of him. That's why I go back to verse 2. He was a tattletale. He was always getting him in trouble. And he was daddy's favorite. We see his astonishing dreams. Now, do any of you here dream a lot? My wife almost never dreams. I dream continually. I cannot figure. I thought my wife would tell me the interpretation of these. She'd go, I don't know what it means. I can't figure. Half the time, 5 minutes after I wake up, I wake up and I'm kind of troubled. What did that mean? I can't even remember what it was. What on earth? And of course, knowing the story of Joseph and Daniel and God, are you trying to tell me something in these dreams? Not gotten any answers. So just because you have dreams, it doesn't mean that God may be showing you something. Maybe he is. I don't know. But I'm not saying that just because you have interesting dreams that that might be God telling you something. Anyway, take it to the Lord in prayer. That's the best way to handle it. We see his astonishing dreams. Dream number 1 in verses 5 to 8. Joseph had a dream. He told his brothers. They hated him even more. He said to them, please listen to this dream I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf. I think he was arrogant. I can almost see Joseph coming out and say, guys, I had this dream. I dreamed about these sheaves. And your sheaves bowed down to my sheaf. His next dream, he dreamed of the sun, the moon, and the stars. And they all bowed down to his star. And he told that one to his parents. Verse 8, his brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? Little did they know, as you read the rest of this book, that's exactly what happened. So they hated him even more for his dreams. Now he has still another dream related to his brother. Said, lo, I've still had another dream. Behold, the sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. He really related this to his father and his brothers. His father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down to you, to the ground? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in his mind. He's his dad's favorite. And what's going to make me think a lot of Mary as the angel? And she pondered these things in her mind. She didn't just discount it. Well, we see the brothers' revenge. And this again shows you the hatred that they had for him. Now, I have trouble believing that any of our brothers and sisters and siblings in here we always talk about husband and wife, never considered divorce, murder a few times, and never divorced. And possibly brothers and sisters has even come to a point where, oh man, I wish you were dead. I hope it's never gone that bad. But if you're still here, there's not been a follow through. So I guess if you're the guilty one, you're on safe ground right now. Straighten your act up if you're causing problems, So we see their revenge in chapter 37, verse 12. His brothers went to pasture their flocks in Shechem. Now, they were living in Hebron, and Shechem is about 50 miles away, depending on the trail that they would take. They're looking for decent pasture for their sheep. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them." And he said, "I'll go." 50 miles on foot. Wonder how many days it took them to get there. Maybe if they're in the Dayton run here, they'd have been there that same day. I don't know if you run 50 miles in a day. I'd hate to have to try it. A man found him. Behold, he was wandering in the field. The man asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I'm looking for my brothers." Man said, "They have moved from here. I heard them say they go to Dothan." That's another 15 miles away. So Joseph went after his brothers, found them at Dothan. And when they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. I mean, this gives you a real picture of the harmony or lack of in this family. I mean, so filled, they hated him, and now they are literally plotting his death. Here comes this dreamer, and they said, "Come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we'll say, a wild beast devoured him." What kind of wild beast did they have there? Remember when David stood before Saul in the situation with Goliath? He says, I've killed the bear with my bare hands. I've killed the lion with my bare hands. They have wild animals. We always think of that down in Africa, someplace like that. Hey, we have cougar around here. Anyone here want to take a cougar on barehandedly? A bear? A lion? So we know that they had wild animals here, so they could very easily pull this off, and they tried to. They're going to leave him and let him die without water. But Reuben heard, verse 21, rescued him out of their hands, said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben was the firstborn of Jacob. Reuben further said, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness. Do not lay hands on him, that we might rescue him out of their hands, that he might rescue them out of their hands and restore him to his father." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his varicolored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into a pit. Now the pit was empty without any water. We see their anger is just overflowing. We see now that they end up selling him into slavery. Reuben is gone looking for some food, and they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes, looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is us for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh," and his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. We see their cover-up in verses 29 to 36. Now Reuben returned to the pit. Behold, Joseph was not in the pit. He had gone off for some reason. He tore his garments. He turned to his brothers. "The boy is not there. What am I to do?" They took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a male goat, dipped the tunic in blood, and they sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not." And he examined it and said, "This is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned his son many days. Then all his sons and daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." And his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. We see now his slavery in Potiphar's house. If I've done the math right, I think he was there for 10 to 11 years. 10 to 11 years. Now, this is part of God's training. Joseph caused virtually all of his problems. His dad added to it by making him daddy's favorite. Parents, if you're going to have a favorite child, make sure every child is your favorite child. Counseling I have had and heard of, where there's been a favorite child and the others have really, there's been deep-seated anger because of the parents' stupidity. tearing their children down because they played favorites. Be very careful. Look at what happened here. Joseph fed on that, so he became a tattletale, let Daddy know what was going on to ensure his being favorite, Daddy's favorite. Daddy could count on him finding out what the brothers are doing. So it just turns to a terrible situation. So God has to get Joseph straightened out and turned around. So now we see that he becomes a servant. Well, he's a slave in Potiphar's house. Now, he apparently was turning to the Lord for help through all this. I wonder in the pit if he started crying out to God, realizing that, you know, his 11 brothers do him in just without even thinking about it. Started crying out to God. And we see this because of his advancement. And again, over the 10 years, we look at chapter 39. Skip chapter 38. We'll go to chapter 39. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph. So he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. The Lord was with him. Joseph must have started repenting and turning back to God and saying, God, I know I got myself into this. Help me get out of it. Yeah, I was a brat. I was terrible in my family. I'm sorry. What do I do with my life now? Will I ever see my family again? Apparently, he was still walking with the Lord that the Lord was with him. Verse 2. His master, verse 3, saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight, became his personal servant. He made him overseer of his house, and all that he owned he put in charge. And it came about that from the time he made him overseer of his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. You know, that's the way it should be as we're out working in the world. Wherever we work, we should work in such a godly manner that the Lord will bless our employer. See, the applications can be made back and forth. We put ourselves wholeheartedly into it. That's when promotions come and the boss is pleased because he says, hey, you're good for me. You're good for me. Boss might not even be a Christian, but he recognized that what his business is all about is prospering. He recognizes by whose hand. The Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. We see that Joseph was there for 10, 11 years. But apparently there was something more for him to learn. You go to verse 10 and it says... Well, the verses leading up to this, Potiphar's wife, Joseph must have been a handsome guy and in his early 20s. And she wanted to go to bed with him. And she started trying to entice him and trying to entice him and trying to entice him. He'd have nothing to do with it. Verse 9, he says, there is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you because you're his wife. How could I do this great evil and sin against the Lord? See how Joseph is getting in touch with God? He knew what good and bad was, right and wrong. He knew what sin and evil was. He would not do that. He was walking with the Lord. And it came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day. He did not listen to her. And so one day she really makes a leap for him, grabs his coat, and he runs out of there. And we find that you come down to verse 19 that when his master heard the words of his wife, she was claiming rape, that he was trying to attack her. Came to his master. See, this is going back 3,000 years. Nothing new is under the sun. This stuff's been going on since the fall of man. Now, it came about when his master heard the words of his wife. She spoke to him saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. Who did it burn against? Joseph or his wife? Potiphar had the right to have Joseph put to death instantly. Now, if I wasn't walking with the Lord and someone attacked my wife like that, they'd be dead. Now that I'm walking with the Lord, he tells me to forgive. But boy, would there be some anger issues there that I'd have to deal with against that guy. Potiphar could have had him put to death. He didn't have him put in the king's jail. I think his anger burned at his wife. Because for these last 10 years, because of Joseph's walk with the Lord, he had been blessed. And he realized now he was going to lose this blessing because Joseph was being taken out of the picture. So Joseph's master took him, verse 20, put him in the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in jail. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. Now I'm wondering here, it seems like Joseph's really getting turned around. He had shown self-restraint as he was sold into captivity. It looks like he had a pretty good life there in Potiphar's house. You know, you're doing good for me, my servant. You will be rewarded. He probably had very comfortable quarters and things are going good for him. Thinking that, okay, God's really going to bring me out of this. And suddenly, these accusations, he's thrown into jail once again. But God, I didn't do anything wrong. Have you ever been there? Felt like that? God, it's not my fault. It was her fault. God, it's not fair. Show me where it says life is fair. Not found in the Bible. Not found anywhere. Life is not fair. But even though life isn't fair, the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. And we see him now in the king's jail. He's incarcerated. I was going to have the blank there, incarceration, but I thought it might give some of you trouble in spelling it. So I was kind to you there. Isn't that thoughtful of me? We see him here. His advancement in the jailer's eyes in verses 20 through 23, 21. The Lord was with him, extended kindness, gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer, just like Potiphar, committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Is the world where you spend your days from Monday through Saturday aware that there is something different about you? You don't cuss and swear like the rest of the people do around there. You don't talk dirty like the rest do, to where people say, what is it with that guy? There's something different about him. You know, the world should look at us that way. Not that we're holier than thou, but, you know, there's something different about them. You know, they're not just the run-of-the-mill getting in on all of the garbage and filth that's going around. What is it about them? And that's how you open a door for people to come and ask you, what's going on in your life? Why is it? And you can start to share the Lord with them at their request. We see his advancement there in the jailer's eyes. And then you go into chapter 4. And we don't know how long he was there before chapter 40 took place. But after this, it was 2 years. But we see in chapter 40, verse 1, verses 1 to 8, then it came about these things, the cupbearer and the baker, the cupbearer I'll also call the butler, for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in jail, same place where Joseph was in prison. The captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them. And they were in confinement for some time. Don't know how long. Cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt were confined in jail. Both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. And he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? And they said to him, we've had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Boy, this guy is walking with the Lord. He realizes that we get our answers from God, not from reading some psychology book, although that can shed light, but the main thing is to spend the time in God's word and in prayer. And that's where we get answers to a lot of our life's predicaments. Do not interpretations belong to God? We see, he says, tell me your dreams. chief cupbearer told him his dream. He said, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me. On the vine were three branches. It was budding. Its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to the former custom when you were his cupbearer. Skip to verse 16. Chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, said to Joseph, I also had my dream. Behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head, and in the top basket there were some all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the baskets on my head. Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation. 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you, will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you. I'm sorry, as the news accounts give this, they should have said there will be some ugly stuff divulged here. I mean, you picture that, you think. Thus it came about, verse 20, on the third day, which Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Now, you go back to verse 14, I skipped over. After Joseph had interpreted the cupbearer's dream, he said, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you. Please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house, for I was in fact kidnapped from the land of Hebrews. And even here, I've done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon. Chuck Colson was guilty. A lot of us end up in jail because of guilt. Paul was guilty of preaching the gospel. Joseph was guilty of being a brat in his family. Well, he had grown from that. Isn't it wonderful, all of the terrible sins that we have committed, when we turn to the Lord, he removes them as far as the east is from the west, and he will remember them against us no more. Thank you, Jesus. Oh, I was somewhat of a brat to my older sister. She's forgiven me long ago. But it hits in these families. And I'm sure he was sorry over and over again. But here is where he is now. What can come out of this? Well, as you go into chapter 41, it says, verse 1, it happened at the end of 2 full years. So this is 2 years after the cupbearer is reinstated. We now see Joseph's years of service beginning. We see his interview with Pharaoh. And I'll pick verses out here, read through them quickly. Verses 1 to 8. At the end of 2 full years, Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he was standing by the Nile. And lo, from the Nile there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat. And they grazed in the marsh grass. And behold, 7 other cows came up after them from the Nile, ugly and gaunt. And they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile, and the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 sleek and fat cows, and Pharaoh awoke. And then he has the same kind of a dream with 7 ears. And we'll get back to that in a moment. We see verse 9. The cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, none of Pharaoh's magicians could interpret this, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Pharaoh was furious with his servants, and he had me put in confinement in the house, the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. We had a dream the same night. He and I each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now, a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard. He related to them, and he interpreted our dreams for us. And it came about just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. And he restored me in my office, but he hanged him. So Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph. And they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes and came to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to him, Joseph, I've had a dream. But no one can interpret it. And I've heard it said about you that you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Notice, Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me, but God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. My, this kid has come a long ways. He's basically now 30 years old, been incarcerated in one way or another for 13 years. Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, in my dream, behold, standing on the bank, the seven cows came up. The lean and ugly cows, verse 20, ate up the first seven fat cows, yet when they devoured them, it could not be detected that they had devoured them, for they were just as ugly and gaunt as before, and I woke. And then I saw also in my dream, and behold, seven ears full of good came up on a single stalk, and lo, seven ears withered thin and scorched by the east wind sprouted up after them. The thin ears swallowed the seven good ears. Then I told to the magicians, and there was no one who could explain it to me. Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are seven good years. The seven good ears of corn are 7 years. The dreams are one and the same. The seven lean and ugly cows that come up after them are 7 years, and the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt, and after them 7 years of famine will come. And all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. The seven ugly cows ate the fat cows, and yet they were not any fatter. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because of the subsequent famine, for it will be very severe. Now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God and will quickly, and God will quickly bring it about. And Joseph's thinking. Now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. And let Pharaoh take action, appoint overseers in charge of the land. Let them exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. We think of Joseph as such a wonderful man. Do you realize that this is the pattern for a federal income tax? A fifth, 20%. And we see a lot of the negative aspects of our government take place in this passage here. I'll point them out. Let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, store the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority. Let them guard it. Let the food become a reserve in the land for the 7 years of famine when the which will occur in the land of Egypt, so the land will not perish during the famine. Now, this the proposal, we see his promotion in Egypt to number two, vice president. You know why? Because Joseph showed self-restraint, temperance, when everything was going wrong in his life. Unjustly accused, kicked out of his family, but he did not turn and walk away from God. Now the proposal, verse 37, seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit? So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. So you shall be over my house, and according to your command, and all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. I wonder what went on with Potiphar, looking at his wife. See, I told you he was a good guy. You ruined it for us. But it's going to help out the land of Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck, had him ride on his second chariot, and they proclaimed him before him, bow the knee, and set him over all the land of Egypt. We see his wife and children. Moreover, verse 44, Pharaoh said to Joseph, though I am Pharaoh, you yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh named him Zaphnath-Paneah, an Egyptian name, and gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went over the land of Egypt. Verse 51 and 2, Joseph, verse 50, the year famine came before it. Two sons were born to him. Verse 51, Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble in my father's household. And verse 52, Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Verse 46, now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, 17 when his brothers sold him to Egypt. So 13 years. 30 years when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land. Excuse me. During the 7 years of plenty, the land brought forth abundantly. So he gathered all the food of those 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt, placed the food in the cities. He placed in every city the food from its surrounding fields, and Joseph stored up grain in abundance like the sand of the sea until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. Now, before the year of famine, he had his children. Verse 53, when the 7 years of plenty which had been in the land of Egypt came to an end, the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph said. Then there was famine in all the lands, but in the land of Egypt there was bread. So when the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. And he said, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, you shall do. The famine spread all over the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. The famine was severe in all the land. The very food that they had given as tax, now they had to buy back. And you read this account clear through, and you find the Egyptians end up selling their very lives to become slaves to Pharaoh. And that's kind of almost the taxes we pay, and then for the benefits we get back, we just about have to buy them back. The famine was severe in all the land of Egypt, and the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. Chapters 42 to 50, I'll just comment basically that the family of Joseph moves there. And if you've not read this before, you need to go home and read it. And it's really interesting as you find that Jacob, they are starving over in their home. And they go to Egypt, and the brothers go there. And Joseph now looks like an Egyptian, shaved face, dressed like an Egyptian. They didn't recognize him, especially as he spoke Egyptian. He recognized them. Very interesting story. If you haven't read it, read it. In chapters 42 to 50, we see his family moves to Egypt to join him, ultimately fulfilling his two dreams. The she's bowed down to his. The sun, moon, and stars bow down to him. In conclusion here, we see his godly insights. And this just thrills me. In chapter 45, turn there with me, chapter 45, verses 3 through 8, actually, we see Joseph is now making himself known to his brothers, and his brothers realize this is Joseph. Oh boy, are we in trouble, because they remembered what they had done to him. They well remembered. The vernacular today, our young people would say, boy, are we in deep doo-doo. We are in serious trouble. Joseph, of course, realizes that. He choked up on this. They were dismayed, verse 3, at his presence. I'm your brother, verse 4, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. But look, now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. The famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. But God sent me before you to preserve you. How many times we slight God? He's not any part of this. He's not a part of my hardships. Who knows what God has put us where we are for a particular purpose? Be patient. God's way is always the best way, even if it seems terrible to us at the moment. God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant in the earth, to keep you alive. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and a ruler over all the land of Egypt. I wonder what would have happened if when Joseph got sold to Potiphar, if he had just turned his back on God in anger, walked away from it. But you see, Joseph showed temperance, self-restraint, and he just kept turning to God over and over again. As Jacob dies, and you go to the last chapter, we read in verse 15 of chapter 50, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept." Verse 19, Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in God's place? For you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." And you see that he treated his family well. And it says in verse 22, "And Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. So while it took God 80 years to get Moses ready for 40 years of hard ministry, it took him 30 years to get Joseph ready for 80 years of phenomenal ministry. All because Joseph showed self-restraint when everything in his life was going wrong. Remember, be patient. God's way is always the best way. I don't care how hard situations you have, are, or will be facing, but 1 Corinthians 10:11 says that God is faithful and he will not allow you to be tried with more than you can handle if you walk with him. And he'll provide a way of escape. But we have to show temperance and resist doing what we want to do. Someone upsets us, we want to bash them. Whatever goes wrong, we want to get even. The name of our game tends to be revenge. That never helps. It might feel good for the moment. You might end up doing jail time if you go and do the wrong thing. But revenge, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Whatever goes wrong, according to your idea of right and wrong, recognize for some reason God has allowed it. And he's allowed it for your good, though it doesn't feel like it at the time. Lord, we thank you. You are so faithful. Your way is always the right way. Forgive us for thinking more highly of ourselves than we ought, Lord. We don't have your answers. We are not God, as Joseph said. Am I God? No. We don't have your answers, Lord. Forgive us. May we trust in you as Joseph did, as Chuck Colson, as Manny's dad did, as Paul did. May we trust in you to work your plan through us. For it's in your wonderful name we pray.